This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on financing terrorism. I am joined by Senior Barrister Dr. Felicity Gary QC from Libertas Chambers in London. Felicity leads for the defence in the most serious complex trials and appeals at every level of court, often with an international element, including appearing in high-profile terrorism trials. Felicity is also Professor of Legal Practice at Deakin University, where she lectures on terrorism, war crimes, modern slavery law, and advanced international legal practice. She has been recognised in the Legal 500 as a leading silk and as being fearless and independent minded. Felicity, it is an absolute pleasure to have you back on my podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love it. I love it because your podcasts are serious stuff. This is where we talk about the heavy stuff. So terrorism is not an unfamiliar word to most of us, having heard of various events referred to as terrorist acts over the years. I mean, in my lifetime, the first that I remember flashing up on the news and talked about in my household was the Lockerbie bombing that took place in 1988, with the most recent event being the Liverpool blast in November 21. And the term financing terrorism is probably not something we hear often. And I remember when you mentioned it, that when we were doing our last podcast, Felicity, when you said, you know, we should cover this area. However, I have found it really interesting to research and understand. So let's start by telling our listeners, what do we actually mean by financing terrorism, and what is the main aim of it?
Yes, well, I think first of all we have to sort of remember that there's no international definition of terrorism, so we have to grasp what that is. But generally, if you like, the dictionary would say it's the unlawful use of violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, in the pursuit of political aims. And obviously that's defined more precisely in the Terrorism Act 2000 in England and Wales, and in legislation domestically across the world. There's a background to countering terrorism by countering terrorist financing. So quite a few commitments, certainly at international level, that looked at how are these atrocities being funded? Where is the money coming from? So when we're thinking about terrorist financing and countering terrorist financing, we're thinking of these broad issues addressing jurisdictional issues, safe havens, failed states, detecting terrorist activity through the movement of money, understanding financing across public and private sectors, and of course having clear pathways to investigate financial transactions, whilst at the same time, of course, trying to retain that balance, remembering people's human rights and not putting the whole population under surveillance. All of that in the context of modern technology and modern communication and money moving in modern ways.
So, I mean, terrorist groups need money to sustain themselves and to carry out the acts that they do. You know, so I guess it's raising the money, making the money happen, exist in order to finance these acts that they carry out. But I mean, what are the various methods being used, would you say, by terrorists to finance terrorism? What kind of ways do they kind of work in and operate in?
Yeah, look, it's worth understanding the landscape because we can think about high-profile terrorist acts from a homegrown, radicalised person, often called a lone wolf attack, and we see those in different areas of extreme politics. We've seen it in right-wing extremism, nationalist sentiments, which are caused by economic instability. We see it in extreme religious causes through bombings, mass shootings, suicide bombings. We see it nationally and internationally, massive insurgencies, including rogue states. And I've done quite a lot of work on finance in Myanmar and investing in Myanmar at the moment, where the military in power have been labelled terrorists. So wow. That's the landscape you're working in. You then got to try and look at the type of behaviour. And it's very, very organised, usually very, very organised, the way in which funds are raised with a variety of methods. And it has to be adaptable, sometimes opportunistic, but these links between financial tools that enable the movement of money towards these organised events. And they're organised even if it is a single or few individuals, whether you've got a pocket or cell of people or whether you've got an organised terrorist group. So just to come back briefly to your previous question, before I come to some examples of methods, the aims of financing terrorism is effectively that solicitation, collection, provision of funds, and the point is they're intended to be used to support terrorist acts or terrorist organisations. And money might come from what are labelled legal sources, but there's a real question mark over that, but also from illicit sources. So you might have, I don't know, donations from money that is ostensibly legitimate.
I read those methods
that you've asked about. Yes.
I read that charitable organisations, for example, profits from businesses and charitable organisations. And I thought, I feel, again, another podcast I'm making where I say I actually feel quite ignorant on this subject, because I always thought when you think of sort of terrorism, you think of almost the dark world and you think that everything is underground and it's not something that you would see or read about in a business or a charity, especially. You think a charity, you think it's clean cut, it's above board, but these sorts of methods are being used.
Yeah, look, I think what you have to remember is it's a really, really political landscape. And because we don't define terrorism consistently, it can include forms of political funding. So you might have a charity that's set up to support a particular area of politics that is capable of being labelled terrorist activity because it falls into this broad definition. And I've certainly been involved in cases where the indictment itself did not allege an extreme form of politics. There was extreme conduct and extreme things were said and done, but actually the politics level wasn't as extreme. Whether you can separate those two things, we could have a whole other podcast on.
I'm sure.
But look, financing does come through legitimate sources where you have people or groups who consider that they are financing a political belief that they have or a political organisation that they have, that those of us who are, if you like, into protecting human rights would not consider that to be a legitimate organisation. But we do live in a world where we accept certain levels of politics on the extreme, or at least on the periphery of mainstream politics. So it's a very difficult thing to think about.
I think that's a really interesting point, Felicity, because I think there is a large element of what one finds acceptable, another doesn't find acceptable. What one person calls as a terrorist act, another person doesn't class that as a terrorist act, maybe looks at it as a defensive act or an aggression in some form. And it's literally where we can sit here and say, well, that's financing a terrorist act, or that act is terrorist, so, you know, a terrorist act. One may say, well, no, that's just, for example, protecting my country or pursuing my belief, and here's my political party, we're laying it all out there, these are our beliefs and what we're working towards, and the next person could look at that and say, well, actually no, that's not right at all, that's against our human rights, or that's against our laws and rules and regulations, and therefore it should fall in this category. So it's very interesting when you do take a broader view and look at it like that as a layperson like myself.
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert in politics by any stretch, so I come at this from the point of an international criminal lawyer that does these types of cases or advises on financing and investment issues. And I think what you really have to cling on to is not subjective opinion. You have to look at what the research says, the research about the methods that are used by these networks, often of organised criminal networks funding terrorist activity that results in atrocities to people. And ultimately, where people are suffering as a result of very extreme political methods, whether that's people in power or organised terrorist groups seeking to be in power, we have to look at it from as objectively as we can as to what fits with our notion of post-World War protection of human rights for everybody and not just our individual opinions. So I think that's where podcasts like this are really useful, because we can think about legitimate sources of funds, reinvestment of funds, organised criminal networks, and the sort of quite creative ways in which money goes to harmful events. So some examples I can give you are gemstone dealers. There's certainly one in Australia that someone was accused of being an associated facilitator of Al-Qaeda through being effectively a jeweller in an ordinary suburb.
Wow.
Yeah, and in other cases where we've been able to follow drug money through to, for example, the Madrid bombings, or investment money through particular banking systems that have been identified by the UN. And there are so many ways in which this is done that it's quite hard to tackle.
Mm.
So I think once you can understand the relationship and the potential links between terrorism, organised crime, illicit financing, sourcing, trafficking in weapons and people.
In this modern day and age, as you said before, I mean, let's face it, it's extraordinary how you can send money in seconds through a mobile phone to somebody's bank account. I mean, the way that banking works, the way that, you know, money works has completely changed in the last 10 years of our lives dramatically.
Yeah, look, it's really important to consider how the international community needs to fight against money laundering, financing terrorism, and make that a priority. The International Monetary Fund talks about this a lot, because we have to make an effort, don't we, that we've got stable financial systems with integrity and cut off sources to terrorists who do carry out these atrocities and do create terrible conflicts in which people suffer, some suffer to near genocide, and make it more difficult for those engaged in criminal activities to profit or get those profits to those sorts of terrorist behaviours. So we have to forget what we think about our own finances, if you like, and look more broadly as how do we use the financial systems or the surveillance or reporting within financial systems to be successful in our anti-money laundering strategies and our countering financing of terrorism strategies.
And we've got the anti-money laundering risks known as AML risks, that where countries are actually tasked with saying we have to be responsible in looking at our rules, regulations, procedures. What can we say about AML risks?
Look, I think it's really interesting. There's an intersection here, isn't there, between business and human rights and business responsibility. So we're not just looking at investigations by states into criminal activity that funds atrocities. We're looking at how financial transactions and financial institutions can ensure that money doesn't go in the wrong direction, if you like. So the risk that money is going in the wrong direction, for the sake of a better phrase, is why these frameworks are in place, why we have AML and CFT controls, that's anti-money laundering and countering financing terrorist controls. Yeah. We have surveillance, we have financial organisations that are under responsibilities and obligations to look at where the money is going. So I think perhaps the best example I can give you for the purposes of this podcast is something couple of things that I've been involved with in relation to the investment in Myanmar. So obviously we have the military in place. There's an international fact-finding mission that demonstrates there have been appalling atrocities. The label of the Tatmadaw is labeled terrorist, a terrorist group, and they're the people in power. And yet there are efforts to list property investments, for example, on the Singapore Stock Exchange. So I get involved in saying, well, look, really what this is about is doing your due diligence. Should you be listing this property investment in Myanmar, asking people to send their money to invest in Myanmar, if that money is going to go into the pockets of those committing atrocities? Now, there comes a point where you might not know the answer to that, and in which case it's a risk to invest. So the stock exchange itself may not list that investment opportunity, or they may list it with those risks attached, and institutions have to make a decision as to whether the money can go in that direction. But there's a compliance mesh around the world now that works very carefully to look at these intersections between international criminal law and international financial law that is meant to counter the provision of money to organisations that then commit these terrorist-type atrocities to ordinary people who suffer terrible human rights abuses.
It's very, very, very complex, because as you said earlier, the jurisdictions alone and which laws should be actually abidable, should we say, where in itself. I mean, there's the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, which is sort of, from my understanding, the primary body driving the CFT, which is the Combating the Financing Terrorism Group, which is a cooperative arrangement around 37 countries that work together to make policy and share information. How helpful, useful, how is that really, is it working? Does it work?
Yeah, look, I think we have to have these frameworks in place. We've got to recognise that domestic frameworks are part of a global compliance mesh, and that we have, for example, arrangements through the European Union. ASEAN looks at the financial arrangements across ASEAN. The individual domestic jurisdictions don't function on their own in this financial world, and certainly not in the digital world. So as the digital world creates opportunities for terrorist funding, so there are corporate challenges to ensure that we understand this overlap between corporate responsibility and criminal activity, including extremes such as terrorism. So we have domestic regulations and international obligations, with some states are part of the OECD. The Financial Action Task Force issues guidance, and we commit to combating or countering financing of terrorism through this management of global assets.
Yes.
And so, for example, we might see it in the context of sanctions. We might have a rogue state that is behaving in a particular way, creating a particular conflict. We've seen it relatively recently in Afghanistan and in Ukraine. And sanctions might include the removal of banking arrangements, so that when something that causes people to suffer human rights abuses, a conflict, for example, where people are killed or harmed, then the financial system can step up. So you really are investigating the financing of terrorism from that individual perspective in relation to what individuals are doing that can be investigated at a state level, to what states are doing that can be countered at international level.
Yeah.
So it's about regulatory change, regulatory enforcement, international compliance methods that include sanctions. At the extreme level, it includes sanctions on states that are effectively acting as terrorist organisations.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, they say the CFT is focused on a variety of entities, but such as banks, charities, businesses, and again, you know, these are the sort of main areas of commerce that make the world go round, banks certainly. And when restrictions are put into place for any banking methods, I think that is a serious way of affecting any country or any group of people. But we've got time to discuss one more area. And I think that I'd like to ask for your opinion on steps that could be taken to strengthen the fight against terrorist financing. What are your thoughts on that, Felicity?
Yes, I think we have to accept that we're still seeing groups that carry out atrocities being funded, either under a political label or some sort of extreme ideology. And so you have to have a counter-terrorism strategy. And certainly the UK government issued its counter-terrorism strategy. I think the last one before this was recorded is September 2001. So perhaps by the time it goes out, there might be some more. But having those sorts of strategies that fit with the statements that come out from the United Nations, so you have quite strong messaging, if you like, or frameworks at international level that then have to be implemented at domestic level. And you have a look at those counterterrorism strategies. The government will issue them, so it's perfectly possible for your listeners to read them in detail.
Yes.
And what to strengthen capacity, you have to look at what methods work or don't work to reduce the threat of terrorist financing. So that involves detection, prevention, deterring, and particularly disrupting the flow of terrorist finance. And I've certainly done some research on the intersection between cybercrime, smuggling of migrants, and the trafficking in persons. And there's some really creative behaviour there on behalf of those who exploit people and use emerging trends in technology to carry out extreme exploitations. And you've got to remember that funding terrorism can include terrible things like kidnapping, harm to the environment, cultural loss.
Using vulnerable people.
Absolutely. Mm. So disruption is a really good method. You have to work out what methods do they use, and they're adaptable, and then see how you can disrupt the flow of terrorist finance. It's about understanding the activity, how financial intelligence can be exploited to prevent and then detect illicit activity. So it means that we can engage, for example, algorithms to search for hotspots in the way in which transactions take place. So we can detect hotspots in activity that can then be the subject of more focused investigation.
But even as an everyday person, if you suspect anything, I mean, we see it, didn't we? We saw it with sort of, if you see a package, an unattended package in an airport or a busy place in a tube or somewhere, you know, report it. It's the same, I think it's the same with life, you know, because I see it all the time in the news when you were talking about vulnerable people. Only recently, where a gentleman was kept in a shed for 25 years and used as some sort of slave. You know, and it actually was in the area of Hertfordshire, which is not far from where I live. And you think, how on earth did that happen for 25 years in somebody's back garden in a residential street and nobody else picked up on that? Nobody saw, heard or knew. And I think it's just about trying to be vigilant as an everyday person if you have any suspicion about anything that you think, well, that just doesn't feel right or sit right. There's lots of anonymous ways in reporting, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think... obviously, slavery has been one of the methods used to control people by terrorist organisations and rogue states. And obviously, there's a great misunderstanding around that area of law, this idea that slavery was abolished. It didn't mean that slavery ended overnight. You know, it still continues and it's still a major problem. But in terms of that type of conduct being used to support or fund terrorism, it's really important that your listeners sort of engage in international obligations under UN Security Council resolutions so that we understand this at a macro level and then look at the micro level where the UK is seeking to implement counter-terrorism regimes, including counter-terrorism sanctioned regimes about other states. So my view is you have to sort of lift yourself off the subjective. You, in many ways, you have to lift yourself off your day-to-day life and think of the bigger picture. But then at the same time, think, is that creating a world of surveillance? Is counterterrorism being used to keep me under control when I'm not engaging in terrorist activity, to what extent are my finances being used?
It's a fine line, Felicity. It's a very fine line.
Yeah. How do you keep that balance? How can both governments understand and be aware of emerging terrorist financial trends, and we be aware of those emerging terrorist financing trends, but at the same time expect our compliance net, our financial arrangements, to ensure that we have free and supported private banking, public and private banking systems?
Well, just on that point, you know, when as times have gone on, and I might sound a bit archaic for saying this, but when you're transferring money, you know, small sums, £100 or £50, it asks, what's the purpose of the... And I remember when I first started seeing that in my own banking, I thought, well, what do you mean, what's the purpose? It's my money. I shouldn't have to tell my bank what the purpose is, but you know, you do. You go along with what's been asked of you. And you're right. You sort of got to think, well, where is that line between not feeling like I've got a big brother above me, watching every move and step of me, but then working towards providing protections to the masses in order to, where is that line?
Well, look, it might be different depending on the investigation, or it might, what you have to do, as I say, is look at what the legal frameworks are. Look, what's the international law? What's the resolution that we're trying to implement there? Not everyone is the fraudster engaged in cybercrime or money laundering, but to a certain extent, as individuals, we can be prepared to hand over a certain amount of information about ourselves to ensure that we are participating in that countering exercise. But the reason you then have a due diligence or compliance mesh is to make sure that, if you like, our banks don't go too far and our governments don't go too far. And quite where that line is back to political debate. But we have to remain vigilant and make sure that we basically fine-tune those controls, that we identify the way in which this activity is taking place, whether it's fraud or kidnapping for ransom or direct terrorist funding or counterfeit goods. Counterfeit goods is a terrific source of financing for illicit markets.
Yes.
Pirating, all of those things that we might not come across in our daily lives, but we understand we hand over a little bit of ourselves for the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And then making sure that our systems are such that it isn't providing those in power with access to all our identity, our information, our personal preferences, our own politics, so that we can't be targeted by the very states who are meant to be upholding our human rights. And the human rights framework here is as important as countering terrorism, because it,
absolutely,
you don't want states...
It's linked.
Yeah, you it's don't want states to behave in the way that terrorist organisations behave and to subject all individual people to...
But innocent people, sort of, you know, why should any innocent person have to suffer because of anybody else's belief? I think that's, for me, the bottom line and the sort of most simplest way I can put it. But Felicity, that's all we've got time for.
There's so much to talk about.
I know.
Thank you for having me. There's a sigh from me there because I could talk about it for ages.
Well, this is it.
It's a great topic, and thank you for talking to me about it. And I appreciate it's just a very broad overview.
I hope it
stimulates some thinking amongst your listeners to think about that bigger picture of what we're trying to do and what we shouldn't do.
But this is why we have part ones, and by the time I'm probably very old aged, it'll be part 50 something. But thank you ever so much for your expertise and your insights. It's been brilliant to speak to you today. Thank you. What I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.